Choke points, and it's time to start planning ahead for your travel through Seattle next weekend. Revive I-5, remember that, is back with the first full weekend closure of the freeway. Here's Chris Sullivan.
You will not want any part of southbound I-5 the weekend of Friday, June 25th through early Monday, the 28th. All southbound lanes of the freeway will be closed at the I-90 off-ramp for the Revive I-5 project. The lanes will start being shut down at 7 p.m. on Friday, and they will be closed until 5 a.m. on Monday.
We're going to shift all of the traffic off of mainline I-5 onto the collector-distributor for the entire weekend. That's going to mean we only have a single lane coming out of the collector-distributor all weekend long. There's only going to be one lane of southbound I-5.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says that one lane will extend all the way through the construction zone, which runs to about Spokane Street. The I-5 express lanes will not open southbound for that entire weekend either.
We can't really open them southbound because the express lanes join the freeway after the collector-distributor, and that's part of the area that we need closed.
The northbound express lanes will be open as normal. With only one southbound lane squeezing through the collector-distributor lanes, you can imagine what that's going to do to traffic around the region. Pierce wants you to start thinking about your plans right now.
Figure out where you're going and if you really need to take the freeway. If there are other routes you can take. If you're up in Snohomish County and you're going down toward the airport or Renton-Tukwila, probably want to look at 405.
Highway 99 would be a good option too, but it does come with a toll in the tunnel. That's $1 for good-to-go users all weekend, $3 paid by mail. This is the first of 16 weekend closures on this stretch of the freeway over the next two summers. The first two will be for grinding and repaving. The next 14 will be for expansion joint repair.
This project is going to replace 40 expansion joints on southbound I-5 and another 16 on I-90 and the various ramps in the area.
Pierce knows this is going to be a giant pain for anyone trying to get around downtown Seattle, but he says it's better than having to make emergency repairs during rush hour.
We've actually had 6 expansion joints break in the last 3 months. We've had to go out, you know, late morning, early afternoon, and do repairs on these expansion joints during the week, during full traffic.
By the way, the Mariners are out of town that weekend, but the Sounders have a match that Saturday. Getting in and out of the stadium district that weekend is going to be challenging at best.
Holy cow. This is the kind of thing that you need like a year's notice for, and here we've got about a week.
Yeah, when I saw your face when Tom was like, only one lane of the freeway is going to be open?
Yikes.
Yeah, I know, and what's interesting is I was going to do this story a couple weeks ago because it was supposed to happen a couple weeks ago, but it got washed out by rain. And so, you know, I figured 10 days notice might be enough or 8 days, but you're right. This is going to have a huge impact, and, you know, it's going to be another sunny weekend next weekend, and yeah, plan ahead. I mean, if you don't want to be heading south and going, what? What do you mean the freeway's closed?
I can't think of anything like bigger than this since Doug McDonald closed down all of 405. Remember that from Bellevue to Renton for the repaving thing?
No, that and also when we shut down eastbound I-90. Remember when they were doing all the grinding there also as well, right in the Bellevue area? Remember we had people were going down Bellevue Way and using whatever way to get there. Yeah, this is huge. I mean, think about it. You get off at I-90, stay in that right hand lane. And that one lane is all the entire freeway gets. There's normally 5 lanes there.
Yeah.
This is all weekend. So
okay, but then this is once we bite the bullet this weekend, then none of those expansion joints are going to fail.
Well, I mean, no. Over the next two summers, they're going to be repairing all those expansion joints. It's not, and this first weekend closure is going to be for grinding and paving. So no.
If your student is about to graduate high school or college, I know the exact job where they'll never be out of a job, right?
That's right.
Road construction.
Joint replacement.
What more job security could you need? Yeah.
And believe me, the Department of Transportation needs young bodies. They need a lot of people to do that kind of work. They're always hiring, even seasonal stuff. They can use, they could definitely, because that group of people who do that, it's aging. And, you know, the stuff may not require college degrees. I'm just off the top of my head. Yeah, and you make good money. And, yeah, pretty much job security.
So I'm right.
Our freeway is 60 years old.
I was sort of being facetious, but
no, no, you're right. I mean, they're always looking for hunting for new bodies to work on the roads. It's not a glamorous job. The hours can be bad, weather too, but it needs to be done. And yeah, they're looking for bodies always.
Well, you know, that job, along with the people who pick up the garbage, most important jobs in society, in any 100%. Society, because they keep the roads open. And they keep your neighborhood from being buried in piles of waste. And, you know, when those people disappear, life is not normal anymore.
Society crumbles.
That's exactly
literally.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Let's go to CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Falk. Joe Biden, I have heard him criticized for not being critical enough of Vladimir Putin and not making any ultimatums or threats. Was he too soft?
No, absolutely not. He laid down the gauntlet, and in fact, on one of the biggest issues of the day, cybersecurity, he gave Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, a list of 16 critical infrastructure sectors, energy, water, everything else, that Biden said that the leaders agreed to work on specific understandings, but that these were off limits. And then he said that a possibility is of any size. What would Putin do if a cyber attack took down their oil pipelines and the impact on their energy dependence? And then he said, look, the U.S. has a significant cyber capability. Put those three things together, and it's a pretty clear veiled threat to say, you do it to us, we'll do it to you. So I think that's pretty tough. On everything else, he basically said he agreed to disagree, but it achieved what he wanted to achieve, which was making sure that Russia knew where the U.S. stood on a lot of issues, including human rights and their dissidents like Alexei Navalny, and then going on to talking about areas where they can engage, and that the Europeans want to do. They're much closer to Russia, and they depend on Russia for economics, so they just want a reduction of tensions. Now, on Ukraine, they both definitely did not agree, and they made that point. But on things like the exchange of diplomatic relations and ambassadors, they've both agreed that it's been too long without some kind of communication on both sides.
So that remark from Biden was him saying, gee, it'd be a shame if something were to happen to your nice little pipeline, oil pipeline to Germany, huh?
Exactly. I mean, what he was saying was, look, our meat industry went down. Many companies are going down. All things in the United States are going down. And the U.S. can't put up with this. Now, obviously, arms control came up, too, because nuclear arms are an issue. But much more significant to the U.S. economy today and recovering from the coronavirus pandemic is this silent and secret enemy, and those are cyber hackers. And no one thinks, and President Biden said he doesn't believe, that it's the Russian government, but they look the other way. And so he's basically saying, look, you don't crack down on this, you're going to have the same problem. And that, I think that's as tough as you get.
So you think this is because the criticism I've read of this whole Biden's approach and this whole thing was that he didn't have any real hammer. He didn't have any specific threat. But you say that that's not at all true.
I mean, if I say to you, look, you know, there won't be any problems if you know if I'm a loan shark and I say I break some pencils while I'm talking to you and say you don't pay me, you watch it. I mean, you know what the threat is. I mean, he said those three things in the same breath. I mean, that's a pretty clear message. On everything else, he said there would be very serious consequences if Navalny dies in prison after he was poisoned and went back. He talked about all of the things, including arms control. The U.S. and Russia have the largest nuclear arsenal still. And what they need to do is get back on track on this New START agreement, which limits arms, and it was re-signed, but the details haven't been worked out. So that's really important, and especially because the sort of elephant in the room, China, which wasn't discussed per se, although it certainly was discussed at the G7 and at NATO, China's developing its nuclear arms. So that one is still out there, the whole question of nuclear arms, and that it was something that Biden also talked about. The U.S. needs to coordinate with Russia, which has been a disruptor here at the U.N. and at other places, because what they need to do is deal with the U.S. withdrawal of Afghanistan in order to not let terrorism grow. And he made the point that Russia doesn't want that to happen either. And on the Iran nuclear deal that Russia has to agree to, on some Africa issue where Russia is blocking, or Syria aid. So those are the second tier issues. But on big issues, look, President Biden said very clearly, we're not going to fall into lockstep. But this is not a kumbaya moment, but it's not in either interest of Russia or the United States to have a new Cold War.
That's what he seemed to be saying, is that that Putin himself is not in such a strong position, because he's trying to recreate the USSR. He wants to look like he's strong, and yet he has a relatively small economy and a long border to defend in China, and he's got to rebuild Syria.
Yeah, exactly. And all of that comes at a time when Russia's not doing as well as the United States on the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. and the allies at the G7, including Japan, Europe and Japan, all of those countries agreed to give 500 million doses to 100 countries. And so getting the rest of the world up and running, even though it's not quite enough as far as the WHO, the World Health Organization, is concern, is very significant, because the U.S. can celebrate and have fireworks and say we're out of it, but the coronavirus pandemic won't get better and will mutate to other, like the Delta variant, if the rest of the world isn't getting vaccinated. And we're a global economy, we're a global world, and so people coming to the United States will come back in with this. So it's very important to get the poor countries over the coronavirus pandemic, and the U.S. is much more, and the West is much more equipped to do that than Russia. So Biden gave Putin a little bit of upswing because of just the fact that he gave him a one-on-one eyeball-to-eyeball meeting, but he didn't give him his what he probably thought was his due in terms of making any way, shape, or form an equal.
CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Flock. Pam, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Good talking to you, Dave.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. A chance encounter in a workplace bathroom turned into a life-saving effort. Susan Ellis and Tia Wimbush both knew each other's husbands needed a kidney transplant and stopped to ask how their husbands were doing when they made that life-saving connection. Susan Ellis tells Fox 5 TV in Atlanta.
You learn a lot about yourself and your resiliency, your faith, your friends, your family.
It was back in the fall of 2019 when Tia's husband, Rodney, got very sick.
His blood pressure was at stroke level.
The discovery? He was in end-stage kidney failure.
It was an absolute shock. We didn't understand what was being said to us, what the magnitude was, what that meant.
Within a few weeks, Susan Ellis's then-fiancé, Lance, began to sense his body was rejecting the kidney his mother had donated to him 2 years earlier, after a long battle with kidney failure himself.
One morning before work, my body cramped up. Like, it was just one huge cramp. It's kind of like the same thing with Rodney. They're like, your kidneys are gone.
Both men began dialysis, and the wait began for new kidneys. Susan and Lance moved up their wedding.
It was devastating for me to watch my husband try to be the strongest as he could, you know, for his new wife and his new family.
Then last winter, that encounter in the work bathroom.
She mentioned again that she and her husband were not a match. And I asked her, well, what was his blood type? And she said, O negative.
Tia says she realized then she might be the match Lance was looking for. A few months later, in March, the two couples met up at Piedmont Atlanta Hospital.
When you think about what we were doing, it's actually kind of scary. It's a big deal, but we just had a peace in that moment that this was what we were supposed to do.
And then in a side-by-side operating room, one of Susan's kidneys was removed and given to Rodney, one of Tia's to Lance. Lance says he'd realized how sick he'd become until he came out of his transplant surgery with his new kidney taking over.
I mean, soon as you wake up from surgery, it's like hitting a light switch. You feel amazing. You're ready to jump out of the bed and go run.
And Tia, on her husband.
This is like the happiest I've ever seen him, because he's got this second chance at life and this chance to be able to be fully present for me and for my boys. And it just means the world to him, Susan. It means the world to him.
But Tia and Susan feel they got the real gift here, and they hope their story might inspire others to look into becoming living donors. As we've covered many times before here in the Daily Dose of Kindness, you can go on to live a perfectly normal and healthy life with just one kidney.
From the G and Ursula Show, which you can hear weekdays starting at 9 here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott. You saw the vote. It was unanimous in the Senate by unanimous voice vote, 100-0. In the House, it was 415-14 to establish Juneteenth as a bona fide, real, 100% federal holiday. But there were some dissenters. Of those 14, Chip Roy of Texas said it would divide the nation. And I also got a news release, G, from Project 21, which is a group of black conservatives and libertarians, saying this is just designed to stereotype and cast blame on white people and would divide the nation sooner. So where do you come down on this?
Well, okay. It's great, first of all, that we are all talking about this, especially over the last year. There have been a lot of people that have finally understood what Juneteenth was, because not a lot of people knew that. So I think it's a victory in the case of people knowing about it. Where I am on the holiday, it reminds me of when I was younger and I was a dad struggling, and I would take my kids to the dollar store and I would tell them, have everything you want. You can buy anything you want at the dollar store. And they'd be like, oh my goodness, you're the best, Dad. Because we're at the dollar store, right? Mm-hmm. And this right here is one of those things where it's cool. It's great. People are talking about it, and it's great. It's going to be a holiday. But it's interesting that they were so fast on that when they're still sitting on a voters' rights bill, right? Mm-hmm. When they're still sitting on bills like on the lynching bill in this country. So we know what's going on in this country. All of the stuff that's happening, I would love for them to prevent voter suppression. I would love for the health care disparities in this country to be stopped.
Well, and the voter thing, G, you saw that Joe Manchin came up with a compromise, and Stacey Abrams herself this morning endorsed it.
I did not see that this morning yet. So, yeah,
I was actually surprised. I thought that, I mean, Manchin and Manchin's compromise says, yes, you should check for voter ID. And Abrams says, we're okay with that. I have a feeling because they're going to launch a blanket effort to make sure everybody has like five levels of ID, you know, this time around.
Right.
But, I mean, it sounds like there is some chance of a compromise on that.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, I'm going to check that out, by the way. That's I mean, Stacey Abrams endorsing him. Let me go check that out. But, yeah.
Maybe you can help me with this, because I'm really excited about Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday. And, you know, my recent excitement over even just discovering what this day is, as you said, like on the West Coast, you came over here and were surprised to find out not many people even knew about it, let alone celebrated it like you did back in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to figure out with a friend of mine, like how we're going to celebrate this day with our two kids who are in second grade, 8 years old. And I'm looking up like how to celebrate Juneteenth, how to teach them about it. I've ordered them some books. And part of me worries about appropriating the holiday, you know, that these two white women with their white kids celebrating Juneteenth in the park to teach their kids about it is going to be seen as like a lame attempt to, you know, sort of like put on the costume of Juneteenth, but not really doing anything meaningful. Am I reading too deep into it, or is this okay at the second grade
No,
level?
No. No, you're not. I mean, to think about that, I'm sure there are some other parents like you that are like, hey, you know, I want to make sure I would love to teach my kids about this. And I think that is fantastic. And I think it's great. I don't think, Colleen, that is going to be the issue that I'm going to see. The one of the things that I just, you can hear me holding back right now, mm-hmm. because I can yeah. already feel and just see it. I can see it right now. I can see, like, come on down, 10% off your mattress. Yeah, Juneteenth, right? I can already see Starbucks having a Pan-African brew coming
That's
up.
America.
I'm not saying you're doing that, Starbucks, but you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah.
Come on down to John Deere, you get 30% off. It's Juneteenth, right? So that's what I'm seeing in this, right? I'm seeing the commercialization behind this. And so on one hand, the reason why you guys are hearing me holding back right now, because I don't want to say I'm not happy about the holiday, because I am. But I just noticed how fast they were to like, yeah, let's do it. All we had a conversation in a year and in a holiday. And there's other things in this country that I feel like I would like for y'all to really go. Like, for example, hey, G, what do you want? You want federal minimum wage to move up from $7.25 an hour? Or you want Juneteenth as a holiday?
Well, that's more complicated. I mean, this is an easy one to fix. You make it a holiday. You know, there's no, obviously, zero except for 14 people argument on this. You're going to have a harder time convincing all of those, you know, senators and representatives on the minimum wage.
Colleen, wait. Why is it a hard time? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, wait, time out. What? You mean to tell me $7.25, $7.25, however you want to do it. $7.25 has been the federal minimum wage continued?
It's not right, but it doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. You can make Juneteenth a holiday and still, you know, bang out the debate on minimum wage.
Again, that's why you guys are hearing me kind of subtle today. I'm like, I'm holding back. It's because of that. And so I'm torn on it. I think it's great, but it has a yeah, but feeling. And yep. it's almost like going into your boss's office, if you guys are listening, and your boss says, you know, Colleen, I'm so proud of you. So proud that I'm going to give you a 10-cent raise.
I'm going to put a better job description on your door.
Yeah, so you leave out, and then Colleen, then your boss says, "Now, Colleen, you're happy about that, right?" You're like, "Yes, thank you."
You are not off on this. I'm not debating you that you're wrong about this. Gee, I'm just saying that like we can be happy about Juneteenth and also disappointed about other advancements.
No doubt.
We'll hear more about this starting at 9 with G and Ursula. G, thank you.
See you guys. You can ring my bell.
Ring the bell. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And now here is Rachel Bell to tell us that Seattle has reached almost the end of an era.
Yeah, so this is a story I've done a few times over the years. Video stores almost closing, video stores closing, and we are there again today. So the Seattle Times has reported that Reckless Video in the neighborhood of Maple Leaf in Seattle is closing next month after 30 years in business.
We opened in 1991. On a blustery Thanksgiving day.
Seems like a weird day to open. That is the owner, Mike Kelly. Maybe they got cursed for opening on Thanksgiving
because
everybody was eating turkey instead of watching movies. So they are going to close for good July 31st. You can still rent until June 27th. They're going to liquidate and sell as much as they can on July 1st. And after that, there will only be one video store left in Seattle, which is Scarecrow Video. I interviewed Mike Kelly back in 2018, which was when he was first worried that he was going to have to shut down.
Well, video rental industry is struggling. That's no mystery. No one's opening up new video stores. Netflix didn't kill the video industry, and the internet didn't kill the video industry. People made a different choice. So the consumers are saying we value the convenience more than we value the neighborhood culture of the small business, least as represented by video stores.
So a few years ago when I interviewed Mike, I also interviewed some folks from Scarecrow Video, and I learned something I didn't know about because, you know, a lot of us have multiple streaming platforms now, Netflix, HBO Max, Hulu, Amazon Plus. I mean, I have all four of those things. So you think that you have everything you could possibly need, but you still don't actually get as much as you would if you would go to a video store.
There are a lot of movies only available on disc. not everything is available online at all times, but they are at Reckless and Scarecrow.
You know, because there's movies and TV shows that are constantly coming up and going off of these platforms. And there's a lot of stuff like independent films, foreign films that you don't have access to like you would in a video store if you go to the movie theater. The interesting thing about all this, on a personal note, is, you know, if people have been listening to me for a while and have heard me do these kind of stories of, you know, whether it's a video store or a 60-year-old restaurant closing, I am so sentimental. Even if I've never been to a place, I've never been to Reckless Video, I would be so upset that it is closing, you know, because I like old things and I like vintage and I am not upset. I mean, no offense to Reckless, but I think I finally have let it go.
You've moved on.
I've moved on. I still have a DVD player. I still have a VHS player, but I haven't used either of them in many years. And like I mentioned earlier, I have, you know, four different streaming platforms. And I think what has happened is it's not as much a dismissal of the culture. It's just the lifestyle. So back in the day, going to the video store was an event. You had to plan when you were going to watch something because you could only have the video for so long. So it was an event that, you know, maybe you were going to watch with friends or your partner, or you decided, oh, I'm going to have a cozy Saturday night. Well, now I watch things spontaneously. I rarely plan to watch something on a certain day or evening. It's just when I have time or I'm feeling tired or my plans fall through. And so I don't think a lot of people are in that mode of planning. If there's two video stores left in the city, chances are most people don't live near them. Very inconvenient to go pick it out and take it back. And I think I've just let it go. I've decided now, 3 years ago I hadn't, but now I've decided, you know, the telegraph isn't with us anymore. We don't make phone calls by having an operator connect us first. This is just another thing that was popular and will not be anymore.
Well, I mean, what can you do? And now the TV comes pre-wired with Netflix. And even if Netflix doesn't have the same selection of old movies as the video store did, they make you think they do. And plus, it's like if the Good Humor truck comes down your driveway every morning, one of these days you're going to buy ice cream. So that's how the new TVs are. So at least Scarecrow's still open, right? Are they still doing okay?
Scarecrow is open. Their big move to save themselves was becoming a nonprofit several years ago. Uh-huh. I don't know the intricacies of you know, how that is better for them, but it's funny, they are actually doing something very new, which is not that new technologically, which is they're going to start doing what Netflix did in the beginning, which is a mail-in DVD system.
You
could get something mailed to you, which makes sense because not everyone's near the store. So they're calling that Scarecrow 2.0. I would be upset if they closed because that place is like a museum. They actually have some things on VHS that don't exist anywhere else in the world except for that one copy. You have to put down, in some cases, $1,000 deposit to rent something. That place, that would be really sad if it closed, in my opinion.
Sounds like there are plenty of deals to be had, especially if you're if you're a Tom Tangney type and you like obscure movies.
Yeah, I guess that is the clientele, people who like vintage, people who like nostalgia, people who go back and get DVDs from the old days.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. Oh, Dave, one more thing.
Yes.
Be kind. Rewind.
Yeah. I still have not only the old VCR and, of course, a DVD player, but an old reel-to-reel quarter-inch tape recorder.
Of course.
Because you see, kids.
No, I know.
My 40-year-old stuff, the stuff from 40 years ago, needs a reel-to-reel machine.
You better get those transferred onto something more solid before they disintegrate.
No, I think when they go, they're gone.
Really? Is that how you don't want your great grandkids to one day view them?
You know, it's like some of those old sitcoms from the 60s. Wouldn't it be nice to have those back again, you think? And then you see them and you realize, geez, why did I like this? Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.